Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
The movies depict space as a vast expanse of darkness, punctuated here and there by the light emitted from stars. But light is everywhere, surrounding us on even the darkest night on Earth or out in the cosmos. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. That X-ray you got on your teeth last week, the microwave you'll use to nuke your lunch, and the radio you were tuned into to listen to this show, all of them rely on light. As my guest will explain, light is a lot more than what we can see, and in its various forms, it is essential to our survival. Kimberly Arcand is visual lead for NASA's Chandra X-ray Observatory. Her new book, written with Megan Watsky, is called Light, The Visible Spectrum and Beyond. Kim, welcome to Think.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So we non-scientists, we think we know what light is, but the stuff that allows us to see the world is just like a little sliver of the spectrum. So what is light exactly?
Well, light is essentially energy, and you can think about all the many different kinds of light that are available in the universe. It's so much more than what we can see with our eyes, and most of it is actually invisible to us. So, for example, if we were to look out on a baseball field, if we could only see the percentage of, say, visible light in the universe, we'd only be able to see down, say, the third baseline. And if you could only see down the third baseline at a baseball game, well, it'd be confusing as to what the umpires were doing, what the players were trying to do, what the score was. You'd be terribly confused and you'd probably want to leave the game. But if you are able to look at all the different kinds of light in the universe, from radio waves to gamma rays, essentially, you're able to form a more complete picture of what's around us.
What does it mean that light acts both as a wave and as a particle?
Sure. Well, wave-particle duality is essentially saying that light can act as a wave or a particle, but it truly is neither. It's essentially getting into quantum mechanics here. So light is truly more like a quantum vector field. And Richard Feynman, the physicist, actually has a really great collection of essays about this. And if any of your listeners want to get deep down into the wave-particle duality, they can Google that and check out Volume 3, which talks about some of the uncertainty principles around that.
The sun gives off every known kind of light. Take us down that list and explain what all the forms of light are.
It does. All right. So about half of, or a little more than half, 52, 53% of the sun's light comes off in infrared light, which is how, say, we feel heat. Around 43% or so is actually visible light. And that's actually what the sun is emitting most strongly, which is probably why our eyes are attuned to seeing invisible light. But then the sun also gives off, say, ultraviolet light. And that's, I think, around 5%, maybe 4 to 5%. And, you know, we can think about ultraviolet light, and we're probably somewhat familiar with it because of having to, say, put on sunscreen. And when you hear that the UV index for, say, a hot summer day is kind of high, it means you have to be careful and, say, put more sunscreen on because you could get a burn relatively easily. Gamma rays are also created in fusion in the core of the sun, though most of those are then kind of reabsorbed back into the sun. And during, say, solar flares, you can get X-rays. So our sun is truly an amazing star, and it's a great example of looking at things in all kinds of light so you can get a better picture, the whole picture.
I understand that light speed, light year, is the amount of distance that light could travel in a year. How far is that in miles?
It's pretty far to us. It's about 6 trillion miles, which, you know, to us sounds like a lot, but when you consider how big the universe is, it doesn't actually get you that far. But when we're looking at objects that are, you know, 10,000 light years away from us, well, then that light still takes a long time to go. You know, light is pretty fast. It goes around, I think, 186,000 miles per second, which means that light could zip around the Earth about 7.5 times in just 1 second. I think that's kind of fast for us, at least.
Is it physically impossible for an object to travel at that speed?
Well, we don't have objects traveling at that speed often, I don't think. But, I mean, who knows? We're always pushing the limits.
I've always been fascinated to hear astronomers confidently assessing the elemental makeup of, like, incredibly distant stars and planets. What does light have to do with the ability to do this?
Well, I guess it gets back to being able to tell the whole story of an object. So one of the favorite things of mine that I like to look at with the Chandra X Observatory are things called supernova remnants, or stars many times the size of our sun that have eventually exploded. Deep in their cores when they're still healthy stars, when they're middle-aged stars, you might say, you know, they have all these elements being created in them, iron and calcium and silicon and sulfur. And when they explode as a supernova, they sort of, well, spew their guts out all over the universe, which perhaps is not the most eloquent way to say it, but there it is. So the same iron that's in our blood and the same calcium that's in our bones, you know, that those elements are forged in the hearts of stars. So I kind of think of the universe as an amazing recycling center. It's really adept at reducing, reusing, and recycling. And, you know, I think we're a good sort of product to show for that as an example.
And there's something about the way these elements behave when they interact with light that allows us to sort of tell what they are from a distance?
Exactly. So when we get, say, an image or a spectral analysis of an exploded star, and I'll use one of my favorites, say, Cassiopeia A, for example, it's an exploded star that's about 10,000 light years away from us, and it's located in the constellation of Cassiopeia, which is where it gets its name from. So when we look at the data from that type of dead star, we were able to see that, say, around the outer region is where all the silicon and sulfur are occurring. And you can see some of the calcium and the iron and the oxygen along more inner areas. And what we are able to do is to actually take color and map it to those elements so that we can create an image that shows where all those elements are. And that's getting into something that we call false color, which is not the best name because it automatically sounds very negative, like we're sitting there with crayons and coloring an object up according to our liking. But it's not. It's actually a better term would probably be representative color. And it's essentially just a way to add to the information quotient of that image. You know, there's, if you get an image that's black and white, if you looked at, say, a weather forecast that was black and white, it'd be kind of hard to see where the worst patches of the rain that are like occurring here where I am in Rhode Island, where those patches were occurring. But as soon as you add color and you'll see the dark red, that's where the worst weather's happening, then you get more information out of what's being presented. And so it's the same way with images, both in microscopy, medical imaging, and astronomy. By adding color, you can actually tell more of the story. You can show off the data better than if it were just in black and white.
Do the colors used in those false color representations, are they standardized so that anybody would sort of know what something that was dark purple or deep green meant?
Oh, that's a great, great question, actually. There's not exactly a standard. And of course, things are very different across each field. So in microscopy, colors can mean one thing, and in medical imaging can mean quite another. But there is actually some really interesting research that came out, because in arterial imaging, so the cardiovascular system and the arteries that, you know, surgeons need to look at to see if there's any heart disease going on. Typically, those images are often colored in like a rainbow color scheme. So if you can imagine thin arteries colored with red, orange, yellow, green, blue, a little cyan in there as well. And doctors have kind of, you know, not a ton of time on their hands. They have a lot of patients, and they have to look at this information and try to decide, you know, is there some heart disease happening here? And there was some study done by Michelle Borkin at Harvard University not that long ago that showed if you take that color scheme and simplify it into a very easy, visually speaking, red to white color scheme, you can actually increase the correctness of the doctor diagnoses of the various patients. So, I mean, that's a really interesting real-world application. You know, color in my field is mapping things like elements or topographical features of a planet, say. It's not a life-and-death situation. But if you go into something like medical imaging, those colors really do have importance. It's really important, you know, how the doctor, the surgeon, or the team can look at the image and immediately grasp the information.
I will confess, Kim, that although I probably should know about this, I have never really conceived of radio waves as forms of light, but they should not be confused with sound waves.
Right, exactly. So radio waves are essentially the the medium that the sound waves, that the sound information will travel on. But then you have receivers and transmitters, which actually do the work of creating the sound waves. And of course, sound waves need a medium in order to travel to your ear. So air, for our example, that I'm speaking to you. And in, say, outer space, where there is no air, you, say, can't hear someone scream because there's no medium for those sound waves to travel through.
Why would radio signals be a good choice for discovering intelligent life elsewhere in the universe?
Well, it's, I think, partly just the length of them. The wavelength of radio is really long, so it can travel really long distances and do very different things than, say, gamma rays, which are incredibly high energies. So it just seems sort of a natural fit. If you've ever seen Contact, which is one of my favorite movies, I could watch that 100 times. And it's just a really interesting way to look at what that type of scientists do. And of course, it's not, 100% correct, but it's pretty good.
And why can't a radio wave travel through metal? Is that true of all light waves?
No, some can. So, there are, like we've said, various different things that you can do with different kinds of light. So, for example, in with gamma rays, one interesting application is that engineers use them in testing of jet engine blades. So they will shine gamma rays at a jet engine blade, and if there's any weaknesses, then that gamma ray light will get through, and then that jet engine blade will essentially not be used.
That sounds very dangerous.
Well, it's good that they have this testing before it gets on the plane, so when we're flying across the country, we know we're relatively safe.
Okay, what is radar, and how does that give us information about objects, physical objects?
Yeah, radar is actually really interesting. I mean, you're mostly using things like, say, microwave light to do that. And what you can do, there are a few different things that you can do, but essentially, it's a way to create these echoes, if you will, so that you can find out something that you can't see. You can find out like a remote sensing or a Doppler radar to figure out more information about it. Like there are so many applications for all these kinds of light. And what I like to kind of consider, though, is that even though so many of these kinds of light are rather different, they're all still just light. And there are a lot of similarities between them. And so things that can happen across different kinds of light are actually really interesting as well, such as light can leak, light can bounce, light can be absorbed, light can be reflected, light can be bent. I mean, there are so many different variables that light can do.
How do radio telescopes work?
Well, they're pretty interesting, actually. I mean, the type of telescope that I work on is called an X-ray observatory. And that one I like to use an example just because I think it's very cutting edge, if you will. So in the case of the Chandra X-ray Observatory, there is essentially a collecting device. It's the opposite of what you get at a dentist office, for example. Mm. At a dentist office, you have X-rays that are being emitted towards you. And then essentially an image is created, and whatever X-ray light gets through is showing you, say, the shadow. So a shadow on a picture of your mouth, for example, will show you where the cavity is. So it's, the opposite, essentially, of that when you're working with a telescope. An X-ray telescope is not emitting X-rays. It's recording the information of X-rays being emitted naturally through the universe. So every different telescope essentially does something a little bit different like that. I'm not sure if I totally answered your question. I think I went off a little bit too far. But you can round me back if that's the case.
No, I think it makes perfect sense. We're going to take a quick break now, and we'll come back to the conversation with my guest, Kimberly Arcand. She's visualization lead for NASA's Chandra X-ray Observatory, and she has a new book out called Light, The Visible Spectrum and Beyond. If you've got a question or you'd like to join the conversation, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with test preparation courses for graduate school admission, including the GRE, GMAT, and LSAT. smu.edu/test prep.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with the visualization lead for NASA's Chandra X-ray Observatory, Kimberly Arcand. Her new book is called Light, The Visible Spectrum and Beyond. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. Back for just a minute to radio telescopes. Can we learn different things about celestial bodies by using measurements of different kinds of light? In other words, can you point different kinds of telescopes at the same object and perceive different things about them?
Well, so each telescope's equipment is very specialized to specific, you know, to pinpoint that specific kind of light. So pretty much, you know, radio telescopes are useful for one thing, X-ray observatories are useful for another thing. There, of course, there's a tendency, you can look at the same object with those different telescopes, and that will only essentially strengthen the evidence for what you're trying to say. And some of my favorite images of the universe are exactly that, where we have taken, say, an image of M51, the Whirlpool Galaxy, and we've looked at it in ultraviolet light. And we'll look at the young stars when we're looking at it in UV light. And we looked at it with X-ray light, and we're looking at all of the exploded stars, the older stars, black holes and X-ray binaries. And we look at it in infrared light, and we can see the clouds of gas and dust that are a little bit cooler. And we look at an optical light, and you get that sort of classical nature of the structure of the galaxy itself when you look at it with something like Hubble. So sometimes it might seem like, you know, an astronomer has a different car to drive to work every different day, and it might sound very excessive, but each of those cars is completely serving a different purpose, and the equipment on each of them is relatively different. So I guess a better metaphor would be to say it's like needing to use a different kind of transportation to get you to a different place, whether it's a boat that's going to take you to, I don't know, Cape Cod or the vineyard, or whether it's a plane that's going to fly you over to England. They're all necessary.
Why is Cassiopeia A your favorite star?
Well, I think in that specific case, it's about the amount of information that we have on it. So for my day job, the Chandra X-ray Observatory, it was actually one of the first objects that Chandra looked at it. And Chandra has continued to look at it throughout its 16 years. So there's a lot of data on that object. And what we are able to see is we can see this remnant expanding over time. And when there's this massive object, you know, 10,000 light years away, 1,000 light years across, and you can see it moving over time over those 14, 15 years of observations. It's really incredible. And then when we combine that data with optical data and infrared data from other types of telescopes, we have been able to use, actually going back to medical imaging, we used astronomy and medical software that were essentially adapted to be able to create a 3D model of this exploded star. And that was the first time we were able to ever do that. So we can see this exploded star expand over time, and then we can actually turn it around and look at it through all angles. And then we're able to use essentially 3D printing to print out a model of that star.
Wow.
So for the first time, we are able to hold in our hands a dead star, which to me is just, you know, someone who is in science and technology, that's kind of the absolute maximum for me.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Ian in Dallas. Hi, Ian.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a question. This is something I've been wondering about for a long time, since I was a kid. Maybe not in these terms, but is it possible that there's some undiscovered spectrum of light where colors that we've never even imagined might exist?
Well, that's a great question. And, you know, I think it comes down to, again, kind of like a quantum mechanics thing. I mean, radio extends really far to the left of the spectrum, and gamma ray light extends really far to the right end of the spectrum. So I'm not really sure what beyond that we could discover. And I think, you know, essentially the laws of physics kind of ended at that. But, I mean, we've been surprised before, so there's always room to leave for you never know.
Some animals can perceive infrared light and also ultraviolet light through their eyes. What use is it to them?
Right. Well, I mean, so most humans, of course, can't detect ultraviolet light. Our eyes evolved specifically for seeing invisible light. But with animals and insects that can sense or detect, say, ultraviolet or infrared light, presumably it gives them some sort of edge, evolutionary speaking. So, for example, flowers and fruits can be actually easier to see or distinguish from their environment in ultraviolet light. So if you're in a field of flowers and plants and there's just, you know, a wash of color and a bee wants to, say, go pollinate something and it catches its eye from the black-eyed Susan. To us, that black-eyed Susan looks pretty simple, you know, a little black nub of a base and light yellow petals. But in bees' vision, there's actually a large, rather dark bullseye pattern on the flowers. And the thought is that it's guiding them to, say, the nectar of the flower and pointing it to where to go. And there are also other situations. So, for example, deer. There are certain kinds of deer in northern latitude when it's really, you know, snowy types of climates that can detect, say, urine and lichen using ultraviolet light. And it might seem like an odd combination, but the thinking is, you know, lichen is a food source. So being able to see it more easily is definitely an evolutionary advantage. And being able to see urine is perhaps a way to understand if there are hidden white predators amongst the snow, or perhaps a way of finding a mate in a rather, you know, difficult land to live in.
When I see visual representations of the visible spectrum, I see red, orange, yellow, green, blue, violet. What allows us to see brown and black and white things, things that don't fall along that spectrum?
Well, those are essentially, you know, just the additions of color. So our eyes have the rods and the cones, and we're able to see essentially the red, green, and blues, and everything kind of matches up from there. And what I think is really interesting when you look at human vision, there are some cases where you can see into the ultraviolet. And I think that condition is known as aphakia. And there is a rumor that Monet, the famous Impressionist painting, actually had that. I guess in his later years, as he was, it must have been in his 70s, he developed cataracts. And if you look at one of his late water lily paintings, it was apparently painted in a predominantly red color scheme. And then he had cataract surgery, and it fixed them, but apparently may have left him with a little bit of a possibility of seeing ultraviolet light. Because then after that surgery, his paintings predominantly go very high towards blue and white. The same water lily painting, he apparently went back and corrected into a different color scheme because that was a different way that he was seeing the world. Now, I don't know how strong the literature is to back that up, but it's a really interesting theory. So when you start to think about how people can perceive color, I mean, there's a lot there to be amazed by.
When I worked in television, we used to send microwave signals back to the station when we did live shots. Why are those good for sending that kind of data?
Well, microwaves are actually really good for point-to-point communications. So if, for example, you have one of those little like antennae on the truck when you're out on the spot video, I can't think of what that's called, on the scene, then you can use your point-to-point positioning to essentially get it back. Though, for the most part, if you're using data to go over a long ways, microwaves is not quite as good. You want to go something like with radio for example, and other kinds of information as well. Fiber optics are actually another really interesting thing that uses infrared light primarily to be able to get our information across the internet. So, for example, anytime you're looking at a text, a video, or an image on your cell phone, you're usually using infrared light through those fiber optic cables.
We used to joke that if we, you know, took the transmitter for that live signal and pointed it the wrong way, that we could cook somebody or something. Of course, that never happened. Why does that not end up being a danger?
Well, it's different kinds of microwaves. So just every kind of light, it's hard to categorize them very, you know, strictly. In general, it's like a continuance, a spectrum, if you will, literally among that sense of a continuum. And so each kind of light has a near and a far quality about it. So there are X-rays that are really close to the gamma ray scale that are going to behave slightly differently than, say, the lower energy X-rays that are near ultraviolet. You know, you can look at a solar flare in extreme ultraviolet, which is the higher side of ultraviolet, and you can look at that same solar flare in X-rays, and you're going to see information that's a little bit similar there. So it's the same thing with microwave and infrared as well. So, for example, we know that we feel heat from the sun in infrared light. We feel that warmth on our skin. But if you take a TV remote control and point it at yourself, right, that's using infrared light too, and that is not going to feel warm at all. So it's just the part of it. There's such a huge range, even within the categories, there's such a huge range of properties of the light. It's really interesting when you think about it that way.
Mark in Frisco wants to know if there's any danger of microwave leakage from kitchen microwaves.
Not that I know of. I mean, from what I understand, the amount of microwaves that we're exposed to in our lives is incredibly small. So unless you had your head right in front of a microwave that was leaking copious amounts, I can't imagine how there would be any sort of damage at all. But of course, I'm not a doctor, so I can't, you know, diagnose across the airwaves.
How does Doppler radar work? You mentioned sort of regular radar. Is Doppler particularly good at tracking weather activity because it's different than earlier forms of radar?
Yeah, so radar is essentially radio detection and ranging. And that was really crucial for detection and navigation during, I think it was World War II. You know, you send out these radio waves and you measure how quickly they essentially get bounced back. When you're coming to something like weather tracking and hurricane tracking and all that, you want to use a different kind of technique. Sometimes you're going to use interference. Sometimes you're going to use remote sensing. They're essentially all different pieces of the puzzle. And I think most people, and meteorologists particularly, have to use many different kinds of instruments in order to get a full picture, just like astronomers have to use many different instruments to get a full picture of the universe.
We have another email here, this one from Michael in Fort Worth, who asks, how does light move? Do the particles move, or does it move through a field of particles, or do we know?
Yeah, so light, you know, is not does not have mass. So it's not something that, like, accelerates up to the speed of light. It just exists at that speed, which I think is really interesting. And kind of like when we get back to the issue of the wave-particle duality, you know, depending on what you're doing with that light, it can behave quite differently. At lower energies, it can behave more like a wave, and at higher energies, it can behave more like a particle. But, of course, it's not really either. It's more of a field.
What does it mean when you say you bend light, that sometimes light will bend?
Yeah, so there are so many different things that light can do. I like to think of them as like superpowers, you know. So it can bend, it can refract, it can bounce, it can do all these amazing things. It can be blocked. And when you're talking about bending, you're essentially talking about so light being able to, let me see, a good example would be say refraction, and whether you're looking at a rainbow, for example, that is essentially light being bent so that you can see all of the different colors. And then it can also be, if you look at an image of, say, I think a recent image that came out from the Chandrix Observatory, which is called the Cheshire Cat. There's a lot of light in between, a lot of mass, rather, in between us and that object. It's really far away. And you can see the light is being bent in the image because the galaxies in the image are sort of warped along a path. And that's essentially proving Einstein's theory of general relativity, which was 100 years ago, I think, last month. So Einstein was always right, apparently.
We have an email here from Mark in Frisco who says, trillions of stars produce lots of light. So why does the universe look dark between galaxies? Why does the Milky Way look dark between stars? Why can't we see that light?
Well, there's a ton of space. There's absolutely a lot of space in between everything. So, I mean, if you think even just us, you know, our star, it takes light about 8 minutes to get from it to us, and that's our sun, and it's relatively nearby. But already that's 8 minutes, and that's our closest, you know, bestest friend of a star. And when we start looking out to farther stars, they're much farther away. So even though, you know, these objects are all really huge, and obviously the universe is unimaginably huge. There is a lot of space between them. But there are, of course, certain things that will break those rules. So if you think of, say, a gamma ray burst, which is essentially a really powerful high-energy burp, I guess, flare. I'm trying to think of a nice way to say it, of a newly formed black hole. The light, the energy from that single gamma ray burst event can outshine all of the stars in our Milky Way galaxy, for example, which is billions of stars, in just a few seconds. So all of the light of our Milky Way in, say, a year can be outshined by a gamma ray burst of just a few seconds. So that's an incredibly energetic event. And that's something that, you know, we wouldn't want to be in its path if it were directed at us. But fortunately, it's very, very far and few between.
One thing that I like thinking about is the idea that maybe the universe is not so huge, but we're just incredibly tiny in comparison. I don't know if that makes sense to you.
It does. Well, actually, I love talking about scale. I mean, you know, so when we started looking through a microscope and seeing the very detailed hairs on a flea's leg, I mean, that sense of scale becomes apparent, I think, pretty quickly. And that was in, what, the 1700s, I guess. So it wasn't long before we were able to look even smaller and even deeper than that. So on the opposite side of the scale spectrum, you know, we're looking at these objects that are absolutely huge. And when you consider, say, our own sun, which really, in all of its glory to us, it might be perfect Goldilocks sun for us, is not all that impressive as far as the universe is concerned. It's kind of small. It's middle-aged, and it's doing just fine, but it's not all that, you know, it's not all that in a bag of chips. but, as you know, to us, if you compare the size of the Earth to that star, if you look at an image and say, you know, the sun is the size of a dinner plate, the Earth is going to be the size of a tiny pencil eraser, and even that might be a little bit big. So that's, you know, really a huge size difference for us. And again, the sun is not all that impressive. So when you start thinking about galaxies such as the Milky Way, which is pretty good size, and then you get even bigger into clusters of galaxies where there are hundreds, sometimes even thousands of galaxies clustered together with huge amounts of hot gas enveloping them, those structures are immense, and it's really hard to wrap your brain around that. I mean, I can't, and I look at this stuff every day.
Kimberly Arcand is my guest. She's visualization lead for NASA's Chandra X-ray Observatory. Her new book is called Light, The Visible Spectrum and Beyond. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, or send email to the show, think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with test preparation courses for graduate school admission, including the GRE, GMAT, and LSAT. smu.edu/test prep.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Kimberly Arcand, visualization lead for NASA's Chandra X-ray Observatory and author of the new photo-illustrated book Light, The Visible Spectrum and Beyond. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Okay, Kim, we have an interesting question here from Murali, who wants to know, would light traveling away from Earth contain information, such as events happening or things that have occurred?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that information doesn't just, you know, disappear. It continues on. So we are essentially transmitting information to potential other civilizations, who knows, at any point.
So if they could see us close enough, they could get a view of something that happened 100,000 years ago.
Right. So, I mean, our broadcast, for example, can continue on and on. And actually, there's a really interesting project. The Voyager has that golden record on it, too. That's even more of a very specific form of trying to get our information out there. But essentially, yeah, there's a way for other civilizations, if they're out there and who knows, to be able to find out whether or not we're around. But of course, there's a huge amount of uncertainty just to the timescales of other civilizations being even possible, like around the time scale of our civilization. And that's a whole field in and of itself that I'm not an expert in, but it is really interesting to think about.
From our perspective, looking for planets elsewhere, why are infrared telescopes so good for looking for those exoplanets?
Yeah, so exoplanets are just an amazing area of study. I mean, when I first started working for the Chandra-X Observatory back in 1998, that kind of astronomy, exoplanet astronomy, was not even in existence. I mean, it's been 25 years since the first exoplanet was discovered, and I think it was like 25 years back in October, maybe. So, you know, in the past, I want to say about 10 years, it's just a field that has absolutely blossomed. And there are different ways, different techniques to be able to find those types of planets, those planets around other stars, you know, not in our solar system. And essentially, the system of transit has proved to be a really good one. So it's essentially seeing the blocking of light as other planets go in front and also in front of the host star, and also looking at how the star is pulled by the gravitational pull of possible planets around it. So using Kepler, for example, which is NASA's main mission for exoplanet discovery, they've been able to find, I want to say, 2,000 exoplanet candidates is what the count is at now, although that might be a little low. I know there's like 4,000 objects that are still being researched and trying to see if those are also candidates, but I think 2,000 is where the confirmed candidates still are. And, you know, the types of these worlds are very varied. And, you know, I kind of talked briefly early about us being in a bit of a Goldilocks situation for our lives here on Earth with our particular sun. But it's really interesting to see what other worlds are possible. I mean, everybody probably remembers that classic Star Wars scene of, I think it was Luke on Tatooine, and he, you know, has the double stars setting sun.
Yeah.
And I remember when I saw that as a kid, I was kind of like, oh, that's so cool. Would that be possible? And sure enough, there are systems that look pretty similar to that. So it's definitely a wonderful example of art imitating life, I guess you would say. But exoplanet discovery is pretty much one of the cutting edges of astronomy in general.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Jim on the line in Dallas. Hi, Jim.
Oh, thank you. I have a simple question. I just wanted to know what your guest knew about the relationship between photons and neutrinos. And I'll just listen. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Sure. That's not actually much that I know about those, so I would have to beg to pass on that one, unfortunately.
All right. We have one other question here from Richard in Dallas. Hi, Richard.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This is a great topic, by the way. I have a question. When observing stars and looking at like spectrum analysis, I know that we can tell the temperature of them based on the color of them, but do stars regularly emit any of their elements throughout their life, or do they contain them until they have a nova or a supernova and explode, and then they let them all loose?
Yeah, it's the latter. So, I mean, typically these things are stored up inside, you know, right deep down in the core. And there's this lovely little diagram actually online that you could probably Google, essentially showing the chemical composition of a star and where the iron is located, where the lead can be, where the calcium is. And then once it goes supernova, it sort of shares its goodies with the rest of the universe. And that's kind of why I like to refer to the universe as the ultimate in cosmic recycling, because, you know, we wouldn't have the iron in our blood, the calcium in our bones, without those stars that went supernova for us in a distant past. So it's a really cool thing to consider.
Sunlight really is a good disinfectant, and that's because of ultraviolet light?
Yeah, exactly. So Ultraviolet light is a little bit more ionized, if you will, than just the visible light that we're used to. So it can essentially disinfect, as other kinds of light can as well. I know actually gamma rays are also used in hospitals to disinfect medical equipment. So pretty much everything above visible light can be used as a disinfectant in some way. And then all those lights can also be used, of course, to, say, image the body to look for tumors, to look, you know, at finding cancer and that sort of thing. So, I mean, we have been able to harness light to do a tremendous amount of good for humanity. And it being the International Year of Light 2015, as declared by the United Nations, I feel like it's a perfect time or opportunity to talk about all the amazing things we've been able to do with light.
When you have access to the kind of amazing technology that you do at the Chandra X-ray Observatory, obviously you've got an agenda and you've got things to get done. I wonder if you and your colleagues also make time to kind of brainstorm about something different you could use with an existing, a different way that you could use an existing technology to visualize something.
As far as the using the technology we've created for Chandra to use for other things, or do you mean vice versa, using other technology to create something different for Chandra?
I guess either one of those, just knowing that this has been used in the past to, say, look for exoplanets, or this has been used to document something very far away. And do you think, what if I took this, say, this X-ray telescope or this X-ray observatory and applied it to in some other way?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, again, you know, I guess I have the pleasure of having been on this mission since before it launched. So I remember the very early goals of the Chandra X-ray Observatory, and we were able to accomplish those findings, you know, looking at these exploded stars, looking at how galaxies collide, looking to see what black holes do. And with each subsequent, you know, discovery, you know, you're also at the same time as a scientist, you're looking at all other kinds of light as well. So it always makes sense to be able to figure out, well, can Chandra look at that too? So exoplanets, going back to that for a second, is actually a really good example because, again, when Chandra was launched, exoplanets, that field was not really in existence yet. It was coming up, but it wasn't well formed. And Chandra has been used to be able to look at some of these exoplanet candidates and their host stars to see what's going on. So I think it's a case, you know, whenever there's any kind of progression like that, you know, Chandra is an amazing piece of equipment, and there's still nothing to this day coming up anytime soon that will be able to surpass it. So being able to utilize that telescope for as many different kinds of research discoveries as possible only makes sense for us, you know?
Yeah. All right, let's go back to the phones now at 800-933-5372. We have Larry on the line in Dallas. Hi, Larry.
Hi. Great subject. Very fascinating. Back in the day, I worked out with some people at UT Austin on the Space Lab program, but that was low many years ago. Anyway, my question is regarding reflection. And it's my understanding that electromagnetic radiation comes in, it's absorbed by the material and re-emitted at some other different frequency. Is that correct? And, you know, it has practical applications in terms of insulation for housing and so forth. I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Thanks for your call.
Sure. Yeah. Reflection, I think, is really interesting to study, you know, because most objects themselves don't naturally emit light. Rather, they're reflecting it from some sort of source, like a light bulb or sunlight or something like that. So, you know, those it's essentially, you want to think of reflection as light bouncing, you know, so there are two rays. There's an incoming ray, which is called the incident ray, and there's also an outgoing ray, which is the reflected ray. And all the reflected light essentially obeys the rule that says the incident ray strikes the surface at the same angle, and then that's reflected. The reflected ray bounces away from it. So, for example, you think of a lake, and you're seeing the reflection of, I don't know, the sky or something like that in a lake. You're essentially seeing the bounce. So I think there's, you know, a lot of practical applications to consider when you think that, you know, that light essentially is bouncing. I don't know if that helps the listener since he's now offline, but hopefully it does.
We have an email here from Teresa in Irving who wants to know, can light determine where dark matter is, and does dark energy emit light?
Dark matter and dark energy are both, to me, fascinating things to consider. I mean, there is, again, this is something that when I was first starting out, there was not a whole lot of research about them. And now we know that, oh my gosh, I think it's like 95% of the universe is essentially, quote, dark, whether that darkness is dark matter or dark energy. And you can kind of think of those two things as like a push and a pull. You know, dark matter is a hypothetical kind of matter that we can't see with telescopes, but we can infer that it's accounting up for most of the matter in the universe, essentially. And dark energy, again, that's another thing that we can't see at all. So dark matter, dark energy, these aren't things that are emitting or observing light. So, you know, proving that they're there is really tough. But if you look, there was one really good example of an object that was called the Bullet Cluster. And in that image, it was using, I think it was optical data from the Hubble Space Telescope and Magellan, I believe, as well. And then the X-ray data was from, of course, yours truly, the Chandra X-ray Observatory. And essentially, in the Bullet Cluster, there's two colliding clusters of galaxies. And you're able to see that there is essentially material that is essentially a representation of the dark matter. It's shown by looking at a lensing map. And it's hard for me to talk about this without showing. I really want to show the image. Because if you can consider what a bullet looks like, that's kind of what this cluster looks like. It looks like there's like a point and it's moving through a medium. And that was one of the first images that actually showed that dark matter was something that you could really sort of, you know, wrap your head around. So, again, I don't know if that helps the speaker, I mean, the question exactly, but that for me is a really good example.
So as visualization lead for the Chandra X-ray Observatory, your job is to take the information that's collected and present it in such a way that people can understand it visually?
Exactly. I like to call my job like a storyteller, but using data. So the types of things that we've worked on, essentially creating visible images using invisible light. And, you know, there's definitely a trick to that. It's a translation process. We use very specialized software in order to create the representation of the object from those ones and zeros that the information is coded in when it comes down from the satellite. And all of that information, it starts out in black and white because, again, this is something that we can't see. So then we have to essentially topographically map color to it in some way, whether that's by geological feature or energy or temperature, that sort of thing. But the job also entails a lot more than that. It's, you know, tweeting about a star. It's working on 3D models of things like exploded stars and planets, and it's setting up things like exhibits. So it's a pretty all-encompassing job, and I can't lie, it's a pretty amazing job.
How different is the stuff that you package for the general public, things like this book, from information that you prepare for use by fellow scientists?
Well, it is different, but I think mostly what I like about being able to write books is that it gives us more creative leeway, if you will. You know, we have a much broader set of topics to cover when we're doing our storytelling, and we can use imagery from all different kinds of science. And then what that does is really allow us to thread those sort of common themes of, in this case, light throughout the book. So, you know, you can talk about the different kinds of properties that light has, whether it's radio or X-ray or gamma ray, but it's really interesting to think about those similarities. You know, what if you look at atomic collisions across different kinds of light, you know, you see similar properties. You see, say, for example, aurora on Earth is a good example for that. But then you can also see that same property occurring in a spinning, rapidly spinning neutron star. Mm. So it's just a way of looking at the universe, whether it's here on Earth or way up above, in a whole new light.
Kimberly Arcand is visualization lead for NASA's Chandra X-ray Observatory and co-author of the new book, Light, The Visible Spectrum and Beyond. Kimberly, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thanks. It was really fun.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.